From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And here we are on Friday of a week that started with the resignation of President Trump's national security advisor, Michael Flynn, and was followed by the withdrawal of his nominee for labor secretary, and then that news conference yesterday. So lots to talk about with NPR politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with the issue of the national security advisor. Trump apparently offered Michael Flynn's job to retired Vice Admiral Robert Harward yesterday, and Harward turned him down. Why?
Well, there were a lot of different possibilities or reasons why Harward may have turned it down, some of it having to do with his ability to pick his own staff. You know, was cited in a statement that ABC News put out where he was a consultant that he was having – that he would have to wind up working with full focus, and he wasn't necessarily ready to do a job that would require him to be on 24/7. Of course, behind the scenes, you do wonder if some of the issues of having Steve Bannon, the chief strategist, as a permanent member of the National Security Council and not really giving over full power to the National Security Advisor within that hierarchy, I think that's continued to be a problem.
And we were looking, and it turns out that there are still hundreds of positions that need a presidential nomination that haven't been made yet. Are they? Is this normal to be this behind the curve on just filling these positions?
Well, you know, the transitions during campaigns, they realize that they have to get about 4,000 positions or so that need Senate approval through. This has taken longer than usual, but some of that, you know, Donald Trump likes to blame Democrats for holding up cabinet position nominations. You know, it's not so much that it's Democrats, but Democrats are saying that they're refusing to sit for hearings on some of these folks until their paperwork is finished, which, you know, has been made more complicated by the fact that so many of these nominees are people who are wealthy and are more complicated to get their paperwork
right
through and are not, you know, don't have much government experience and been pre-vetted before.
And what about that news conference yesterday, Domenico? Let's listen to a moment from that.
Again, I say it, there has never been a presidency that's done so much in such a short period of time. And we haven't even started the big work yet. That starts early next week.
So just to remind people of what happened here, the president called a news conference around 11 a.m. for 12 p.m. Eastern time. It started at 12:30, or was supposed to, started a little bit later than that. He spoke for about 30 minutes, just the beginning of which was news about his new labor secretary choice. And then he went on this tirade against the media and list of accomplishments that he says he's made in the first few weeks of the presidency, and then got really feisty with a lot of reporters. What do you make of that?
Well, he clearly wanted the fight. There's no question about that. And, you know, to that soundbite that you played, I mean, him saying that he doesn't think that there's ever been a president who's accomplished that much within a short period of time. You even had Stephen Miller, policy advisor within the White House, go on a Sunday show and say within 4 years there have been presidents who haven't accomplished what this president has. But we can't just let that hang out there. I mean, if you think about this, you don't have to go too far back to see that that's not true. I mean, just 8 years ago to this day, February 17th of 2009, President Obama signed the $787 billion stimulus
right
that got through Congress with no Republican votes in the House, with only 3 Republican votes in the Senate. And most people, you know, people can argue about this, but most economists will give credit to the stimulus for helping stabilize the economy after the 2008 Great Recession. So that's certainly been more consequential than anything Donald Trump has done so far. He signed a lot of executive orders. He did them almost on a daily basis for a couple of weeks, but only one of them really had a lot of teeth, and that was the travel ban, the immigration travel ban, and that had such a messy rollout, got swatted down by the courts, and in fact, they're going to have to start from ground zero and put out something, they're promising something else next week.
And do we know anything about what that is going to look like next week?
We We don't, you know, and it's difficult to see just exactly how they're going to put it out. He was asked about that piece of substance yesterday and didn't answer. So, you know, a lot of what Donald Trump has done, he's made lots of statements of principle that signal the direction he wants to go. But has some of that been bluster? Definitely.
Well, today, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said Trump should stay on message more and tweet less. Here's what he said about hopes for getting tax reform and Obamacare repeal done in Congress.
Clearly, this is not one of those bipartisan kumbaya moments. And so we, as Republicans, expect that both of those issues will be, which are very big issues, will have to be tackled Republican only.
Does it look like Republicans will be able to hold together on some of those big issues like repealing and replacing Obamacare? Because it does sound like we're hearing different things from different Republican senators about what they want.
Well, they certainly – there's a couple different things here. I mean, you know, healthcare law is very difficult to unwind, and Republicans understand this. They had – they have until about February 27th to those committees to get through the plans that they want to get through based on Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House's timeline. And those are currently being scored by the Congressional Budget Office. So it seems they have made some progress toward that, but there are some disagreements and they are very difficult to get through. On tax reform, it's something else that Republicans want to get through. And the Republicans generally with the White House are on the same page. So when Mitch McConnell says he doesn't think Donald Trump should be engaging in this extracurricular fighting with the media or right. tweeting as much as he is, they're still on message when it comes to that. He said that he wants them – that they will soldier on. And it's almost as if he's saying, nevertheless, we persisted.
Domenica Montanaro, lead politics editor at NPR. We didn't even get to Trump forcing meatloaf on Chris Christie. But thank you for joining
us. That sounds delicious.
Well, a bill has advanced in the Oklahoma state legislature that would require a pregnant woman who is seeking an abortion to get consent from the man who impregnated her. The Center for Reproductive Rights calls the bill unconstitutional, but the Republican state representative who wrote the bill is defending it. Justin Humphrey told the online news site The Intercept that men should have a say in abortions, not just pregnant women, because women are, quote, hosts for fetuses. Dale Denwalt has been covering the story for The Oklahoman. He is Capitol Bureau Chief there, and he joins us from Oklahoma City. Dale, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell us more details about this bill. Exactly what does it propose and how would it work?
So what it proposes is that if a woman is going to get an abortion, she has to get permission from the father. And if the father at any point objects to – or the supposed father objects to paternity and asks for a paternity test, then she wouldn't be able to get an abortion.
Is there a time frame in which this permission has to be granted?
Well, Oklahoma limits abortions beyond 20 weeks, so any time before that.
Okay. So before 20 weeks. And is it verbal permission, written permission? What is it?
I believe it's going to be written permission, probably something like a signed affidavit. And the woman also has to inform her doctor who the father is.
Does it apply in cases of rape or incest?
Well, this bill does provide exceptions for rape, incest, and the health of the mother.
Okay. So let's read a little bit more of what Representative Humphrey has said about his proposal. He spoke specifically about women. He said, quote, "I understand that they feel like it's their body, but after you're irresponsible, don't claim, well, I can just go do this with another body when you're the host and you invited that in," end quote. What's been the reaction to these comments there in Oklahoma?
Well, there's been an incredible reaction from a lot of people who feel like that was a degrading comment from organizations like Planned Parenthood and other women's rights organizations that say, you know, first of all, we're not hosts. We're pregnant women. And it garnered a lot of attention. And I'd say when the bill eventually got to committee, it was a packed house.
It was a packed house. Okay. So where does the bill stand now? What's likely to happen to it?
Right. So the bill has advanced past the committee stage, and at this point it is eligible for a floor hearing. It's hard to say whether it's going to get a floor hearing. Bills that have come out of committee in the Oklahoma House still have a few weeks left before that deadline. But I know that some leadership in the state house, a Republican-controlled state house, have said, listen, we're going to focus on the budget this year, not some of these social issues.
I see. Well, let's talk a little bit about the laws that are on the books in Oklahoma. I mean, because last year, lawmakers passed a bill that effectively banned abortions. But that one, however, was vetoed by Governor Mary Fallon. She called it unconstitutional. But can you just walk us briefly through what the laws are in Oklahoma regarding abortion?
Right. Americans United for Life, it's a pro-life group. They rank Oklahoma as number one in the nation on pro-life laws. Here in this state, like I said, we have you can't get an abortion beyond 20 weeks except for some limited circumstances. Public funding isn't really available for abortion. The parent of a minor must give consent for their minor to get an abortion, and insurance policies only cover abortion in the cases of life endangerment.
Hmm. Now, about this new proposal, do we know if it makes it to Governor Mary Fallon's desk? Do we know how she feels about this law?
She hasn't come forward and talked about any particular legislation. It's still really early in the legislative session, but Governor Mary Fallon is a pro-life politician. But as we've seen with last year's veto of a bill that would essentially outlaw abortion, she does take those unconstitutional allegations seriously.
Well, Dale Denwald is Capitol Bureau Chief for The Oklahoman. Dale, thanks so very much.
Thank you.
Rain is already falling in Southern California, and the region is bracing for the worst storm to hit there in years. We're joined by Rick Dickert, certified broadcast meteorologist at KTTV in Los Angeles. And Rick, to start, how much rain are we talking about?
We're talking about 4 to 5 inches in and around the downtown LA area, but perhaps as much as 10 inches in some of those south-facing slopes of the foothills and mountains. We call it an atmospheric river, and it has a bullseye right on Southern California. It's a fire hose of moisture. A strong atmospheric river, or AR as we call it, transports as much water equivalent to 15 times the average flow at the mouth of the Mississippi River.
And you've already had a number of these atmospheric rivers this year. Is this one going to be that much worse than the others?
We're busting the drought. This will be the strongest storm thus far. In fact, the strongest since at least 2010, possibly back as far as 2004. And so far, before the first drops from this storm, here in downtown LA, we've received 16.25 inches of rain. During an average entire water year, which starts on October 1st and ends on September 30th, we typically receive 14.93 inches. So we're already an inch plus above that. We're coming off of 5 consecutive rainfall seasons with below average totals, below 10 inches, in fact.
So what are the fears about what all of this water is going to do in Southern California?
Well, we have flash flood watches up for the entire region, even for the desert communities because of the heavy rain. This is a very dangerous storm. In fact, the National Weather Service is billboarding it as a dangerous storm. In addition to the rain, we're going to have those high winds, tropical storm force sustained winds. That means 39 miles an hour or stronger. But we could see some gusts in the hurricane force range, high surf as well. This is going to be a very powerful system.
Now, what does this mean for the Oroville Dam, if anything, the dam that's been kind of bursting at the seams up further northern California?
Fortunately for them and unfortunately for us, the bulk of this system is going to be on the southern half of the state. Yes, they're going to receive more rain, but not as much as we are here in Southern California. There still are some concerns up there because the water levels will increase yet again, so they will definitely be monitoring it. We have our own dams here in Southern California we have to watch as well, a number of dams. And with the kind of totals that we're expecting, we're really worried about elevated water levels. On February 17th, the record rainfall for downtown LA is 2.18 inches. That was set way back in 1884, Jeremy. We're anticipating totals around 4 inches. We're going to receive as much rain in a 24-hour period that is typical for an entire month of February in the LA area.
And I know that one of the things that you monitor, Rick, because I've been with you in the helicopter above Los Angeles, is the traffic, and I'm sure it's going to be a nightmare because of this.
It's a mess. We just landed. We're braking for fuel right now, and already the incidents are stacking up. Jackknife big rigs, cars spinning out. Even though we've had several wet commutes with this winter season, people still just go too quickly. When the volume is light, they think they can go 65, 70 miles an hour. Doesn't work. The rain is just ramping up. It will be heaviest, though, during the evening commute. And this is a getaway Friday for many people with the President's Day holiday coming up on Monday.
That's right. Rick Dickard, certified broadcast meteorologist with KTTV in Los Angeles. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.
These days, it seems someone is always trying to sell us something.
We started by launching the first luxury hybrid, then the first luxury hybrid sports sedan.
We're inundated with ads vying for our attention.
I got a deal. Good. I'm putting you down to deal with Dick. Dick, what's the deal with the deal? Are we dealing? We're dealing. David's a deal.
Careless, reckless, crooked, putting her interests ahead.
Ask your doctor if your heart is healthy enough for sex.
And now, no artificial preservatives.
They're great!
Or not so great. Advertisers are forever searching for ways to cut through the cacophony and visual clutter. Now, two researchers say they've discovered a subliminal, automatic, and irresistible way to direct our sight and focus our attention using different sound frequencies. Bruce Gellerman from Here and Now contributor WBUR reports.
These early findings offer the promise of powerful, perhaps even profound techniques that might be able to tap deep into our psyches, direct our perceptions, influence what we purchase, and the information we retain. Professor Adam Brazel is head of the marketing department at Boston College. He says it has to do with a field of psychology called cross-modal correspondence.
A stimulus in one sense kind of primes us to receive a stimulus in another sense. So feeling a certain temperature might associate you more likely to see a certain color.
You feel hot? That's associated with red. Cold? That's blue. Advertisers use this all the time in visual marketing. One day, Professor Brazel's colleague, marketing professor Henrik Hogtvedt, mentioned something he noticed. Different sounds influenced his visual perception.
I personally associated high frequency with lighter colors and lower frequencies with darker colors, and I became curious about whether or not that was just me or if it was other people as well.
So Hogtvedt and Brazel devised a series of experiments. In Brazel's visual perception lab, they used a device called the eye tracker.
The nice thing with the eye tracker that we use, they don't have to wear any headwear. They don't have to put their chin on a rest or anything. It's a very, very sort of normal experience. It's just like using a normal computer.
The researchers paid Boston College students a few bucks to participate and set them up in front of the eye tracking computer.
And it essentially is able to map the actual movements of the pupil to tell us where they're looking on the screen.
The students saw light and dark shapes, spheres and squares, flashed on their screens. As different frequency sounds were played, students heard seven frequencies from low to high, while the eye tracker followed their pupils. The experiment confirmed the researchers' hypothesis.
Indeed, when you hear these low tones, your eyes are automatically drawn towards darker areas of the screen, versus when you hear the high tones, your eyes are initially automatically drawn towards lighter areas of the screen.
How fast does the association between the sound and the visual happen?
Very fast. It's extremely quick.
The student subjects were given no instructions. The effect operated without their awareness. In another experiment, researchers found different frequencies of a familiar song could even divert normal visual responses.
It's sort of the ice cream truck song, is what everybody thinks of it as. So when you hear this Turkey in the Straw song, there's a conscious effort, okay, I'm hearing this Turkey in the Straw song, I should be looking at the ice cream truck.
But when student subjects heard the high-frequency song, their attention was drawn not to a dark color ice cream truck, but a light color picture of a bus, and vice versa. Low frequency sound, dark image. Professor Hogtvedt says the sound frequencies directed the eye's attention.
Here you have basic sensory input, right? It's just sound frequency and color lightness. And to see that kind of a correspondence guide behavior is absolutely fascinating.
And there's nothing you can do about it. Even when participants were explicitly told to focus on the dark objects or light objects, the sound frequency they heard told them where to look. Sound dictates sight.
So they can't override it immediately. It's clearly an automatic response, presumably hardwired.
In another experiment, the researchers discovered the sound-sight connection could also affect memory and the information we retain. They created two versions of a TV commercial for a fictitious restaurant, putting information about the place on a light-colored background or a dark background. and played two versions of this song, one pitch low, one high.
And what we were able to show is that when we played the soundtrack with the very low tones, people remembered the restaurant information that was on the dark background, versus when we played the high tones, people remembered the information out of the commercial that was on the bright background.
Which brings us to their fifth and final experiment. This one was conducted in a Norwegian supermarket.
I'm Norwegian, and I tend to go to Norway, usually during the summer.
Professor Hagtvedt stacked two shelves with bananas. One shelf light-colored, the other dark.
And then we played music in the supermarket that was low-frequency or high-frequency. It was the same music, the only differences were in the frequencies. And then observed, the people who are buying bananas, from where are they actually taking those bananas? From the light-colored shelves or from the dark-colored shelves? And as it turned out, when the high-frequency music was playing, more people took bananas from the light-colored shelves as compared to the dark-colored shelves, and vice versa when they were playing low-frequency music.
What a powerful marketing tool.
Yeah, being able to actually show this effect is taking place in the real world with actual behavioral consequences is sort of one of the key pieces of the paper.
Hagtvedt and Brazel's paper, Cross-Modal Communication, Sound Frequency Influences Consumer Responses to Color Lightness, was published in the Journal of Marketing Research.
We can use this not only in a retailing context, but what about online, where color and sound might be among the only stimuli that you have? We can guide visual attention online or on TV. Yeah, there are so many applications that it would be difficult to list them.
We have shown that marketers or educators or politicians or whoever can, to some degree, guide your visual attention based on the tones that you're hearing, and that might cause you to attend to some visual information more so than others, so you may be able to shape a narrative a little bit, but it's not quite to the point of psychological programming or that old subconscious research where we're making people do things illicitly.
So the next time you're at a supermarket or a political rally, keep your eyes and ears open. And watch what you're listening to. For Here and Now, I'm Bruce Gellerman.
This is Here and Now.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist, from politics to business and finance. From science and technology to the arts, readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
In January, President Vladimir Putin was the second most mentioned person in Russian media. Number one, President Donald Trump. During the U.S. election, Trump received largely glowing coverage from Russian TV and newspapers, but that's changing. For example, Russia's most popular tabloid recently accused Trump of making contradictory comments about NATO and concluded, quote, "You need to be drunk to understand the true position of America's president." BBC correspondent Sarah Rainsford joins us from Moscow. And Sarah, first of all, tell us more. You say that you've detected a change in the tone regarding the Russian media.
Yes, definitely. It's been happening over the past few days, really. And I think it reflects what Russians are seeing as a bit of a shift in position in Washington. So that's starting to show in the way that the newspapers here and the TV too. Because as you mentioned, during the campaign, there was an awful lot of very, very positive talk about Donald Trump. And particularly, of course, this focus on the fact that he'd been positive about Vladimir Putin. So that was reflected then on state media here. We've seen that change in the last few days. And as I say, I think that's because policy in America looks like it's changing. We've heard comments from Donald Trump about NATO, which suggests that he might not be backtracking on commitments to supporting NATO as Russia had hoped. And we've also, particularly importantly for Russia, heard about Crimea. The White House has started to talk about the need for Russia to return Crimea to Ukraine. Now, that's a total no-go. Moscow annexed Crimea. It believes it is Russian territory and there's no way it wants to give it back. And so I think that's why the tone has shifted here.
And so given that this is state-run media in Russia, is this change in direction being ordered by the Kremlin?
Well, it's interesting. The newspapers aren't all state-controlled, and that kind of coverage shift has been detected. I have detected that in the papers too, but certainly I think state TV is interesting to watch. And there have been reports this week that, in fact, state TV was ordered to rein in its coverage of Donald Trump, to tone it down. Now, when we asked the Kremlin about what was going on, the Kremlin spokesman denied that there was any order from the Kremlin to tone in the coverage. He said that was absolute rubbish and it was fake news, and he claimed that the state TV channels here set their own agenda, but we know that's not true.
It's so interesting. The Russian spokesman said it was fake news as well. Well, so I have to ask you, Sarah, given that, I mean, how much of this, or does any of this have to do with the fact that, you know, there are investigations going on in Washington now about Russian interference in the election and how much members of the Trump administration knew and when, if anything? I mean, there's a great deal of scrutiny about Trump and Russia going on in America right now. I mean, is this distancing by the state-run media in Moscow a response to that?
Well, it could well be. I guess there are people in the Kremlin who are worried about what might come out. Of course, officially here, there are total denials that there was any improper links between Washington and Moscow in the run-up to the election. That's been flatly denied by the Kremlin. But perhaps there's concern about the way things are going. I mean, in terms of the official position, then, the Kremlin saying, look, this won't be resolved. We won't really know what the relationship between Moscow and Washington can be like until Presidents Trump and Putin sit down and talk. I think the Kremlin really thinks a lot of this is going to come down to personal chemistry. But I think whilst they used to be pretty positive about that in previous weeks, I think now there's a suggestion here that people believe that that Donald Trump is coming under pressure to change his positions on things. And people here think that means he's not going to be able to make any concessions to Russia, even though they believe he might have wanted that.
Well, Sarah Rainsford is the BBC's correspondent in Moscow. Many thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
It's time now for a classical edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Terrence McKnight is a DJ at WQXR in New York. Terrence, welcome back.
Nice to be back, Jeremy.
And you have some music that you've come across recently. And first of all, you wanted us to hear a version of a piece by pianist Fats Waller. First, we're going to hear the original, played by Waller. This is called Handful of Keys. Okay, and now let's listen to that piece performed by the Speakeasy String Quartet. So how difficult is it to arrange a piano piece like this for a string quartet?
I don't know, but I've never tried. I tell you what, I've tried to sit down and imitate Fats Waller at the piano, and that's very difficult. And what's so amazing about what the Speakeasies have done, not only have they made an arrangement, but this is like a note-for-note transcription. So the ability to go in and really hear every note that he played and transcribe it for those four instruments is probably pretty difficult, but I guess, you know, it's so much fun to play it.
And that original piece by Fats Waller, tell us about that one. It really takes you back to a different era.
Handful of Keys, man. You know, when you think of Fats Waller, you have to think of, you know, back in the early 1920s, Shuffle Along, going on Broadway, and all of this black culture, you know, being on Broadway and then starting to go around the world where they were coming out of ragtime and the piano style was going into stride piano, so you could hear that in that left hand, that mcha, mcha, mcha. So that really kind of defined a whole new era of American music. It was kind of the precursor to jazz.
And this newer version from the Speakeasy String Quartet, who are they?
Oh, it's a group, man. I think, you know, these guys are based in Los Angeles. They work between here and the West Coast. And this group came together back in the early 90s, and they came together with the idea of bringing that music back from the 1920s and 30s, you know, that early jazz, and bringing it to the concert hall because, you know, string quartet, typically you think maybe Beethoven, Mozart, Schubert, but, you know, so they wanted to take this early American music, this early form of American music, and set it for those four classical instruments, taking it to the concert hall. So, you know, musicians around the country, by way of their publishing these scores, you know, music, string quartets around the country can play, you know, can play this music.
Yeah. All right. Well, next we have the Ethiopian composer and pianist Girma Yefreshewa. This is called Semimen. So tell us about this one.
As he continues to play this music, Jeremy, you'll hear these modes that come, you know, that precede our kind of major minor tonal system. And Girma, you know, grew up playing this instrument, this Ethiopian string instrument called the kirar. And he saw a piano when he was 16 years old and decided that's what he wanted to do. So he ended up leaving Ethiopia and going to Bulgaria to study piano, ended up spending time in Italy, and then decided, you know, after playing the classics, you know, the Schubert, the Brahms, and Beethoven, he wanted to bring his own musical heritage to the piano. So take it from the kirar and set it for the piano. So he became a composer and he uses these Ethiopian modes in his music. And this piece is called Semimen, which means half asleep, half awake, half dead, half alive. And it uses all of those old modes from Ethiopia.
All right. Well, the next one that you brought us is from composer David Rakowski with Amy Briggs on piano. I love this name. Absofunkin'-lutely. So does that feel funky to you?
It does. Absolutely. I mean, you have to really be careful saying that we're...
Yes, you do. You absolutely do.
Now, this guy is back. He's right in your backyard. And I brought him to you. This composer, David Rakowski, is at Brandeis University. And he's taught, you know, up and down the East Coast. And he's written so much music, man. Sometimes I'll have people ask me, do people still write symphonies? And, you know, David Rakowski has written about, what, four symphonies, I think he has, and he's written more than 100 pieces of piano music, including these etudes that I brought you. That was one of his etudes. I think he has 100 of those compositions.
You know, you start throwing those numbers around about how many pieces he's composed, and I'm just thinking, didn't Mozart do that by the time he was like 7 years old?
Yeah, Mozart was writing operas and
right,
symphonies at
unbelievable.
Age 9. Yeah, he had a pushy father, though.
Okay. All right. Well, on to the next one. This is from the composer Carmen Moore. This is called Wellness for All.
Thank you.
So are those synthesizers?
Yeah, man, and so interesting about this project, he took on this kind of new mantra where he wanted to write music that was all about a personalized system of spiritual practice. That's what he says. And he wanted to commit his art to healing and wellness. And so much of his music is spiritually based. And Carmen Moore is somebody who really takes advantage of the diversity of New York City. I mean, his ensemble is so diverse, not only in their musical practice, but in their kind of ethnic background. So when he says wellness for all, as you listen to that track, you'll hear so many cultures represented by the musical language and by the instruments that he's using. So it's something for everybody in there and something healing for everybody in this music on this CD.
And he's from Ohio, actually.
He is,
right?
He is, as am I.
Whereabouts?
I'm from Cleveland, and Carmen is from the Lorain area, so not too far.
So you guys are part of the great Ohio to New York contingent that has taken over Manhattan.
Leah and Langston Hughes started all this back in the early 1900s.
That's Terrence McKnight, who's a DJ at WQXR in New York. Terrence, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. Just go to Spotify and search for NPR Here and Now. You can also find us on Apple Music or at hereandnow.org.
Alleged voter fraud was a hot topic during the 2016 presidential election. It's still in the news. Last week, President Trump said he would have won New Hampshire if not for thousands of people who allegedly voted illegally. There is no proof for this claim, but on Sunday, Stephen Miller, Trump's White House policy director, told reporters to check with Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State in Kansas. Here's Kobach on CNN.
We will have more information at the end of this month because New Hampshire just joined a 30-state program where we compare data across states.
Kobach's talking about CrossCheck, a massive database that he's used to prosecute six Kansans on charges of voter fraud. But his critics say he's unfairly going after people who made an honest mistake. Peggy Lowe from Here and Now contributor KCUR reports.
Randall Killian thought he was investing in his new retirement property in Colorado when he received a ballot in the mail in 2012 asking if he would like to legalize marijuana in that state.
When I saw that on the ballot, it's like, oh, wow, that's something I'll never get a chance to vote for again.
Killian mailed the ballot back.
So, bam, I vote on it, vote in Ellis County just like I'd done for 25 years.
That's Ellis County, Kansas. Killian lives there. Problem was, Amendment 64 was a Colorado issue on a Colorado ballot. And then Killian later voted in his home state. Some 4 years later, Killian learned of his mistake when he got a call from a reporter.
And all of a sudden, I'm indicted.
Killian's voting in two states got him caught up in Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach's high-profile crusade against voter fraud. It also brought to light Kobach's Interstate Cross-Check program. It's a database that holds voting records for 30 states, centralized in Kansas and run by Kobach. The system is used to look for people who are registered to vote in two states. The goal is to help state officials keep voter rolls clean. Caught in CrossCheck's crosshairs, the 63-year-old Killian pleaded no contest to a misdemeanor and paid the $2,500 fine.
Now I'm the poster boy for voter fraud, not only in Kansas, but out throughout the country.
Despite recent false claims from President Trump on Twitter, it's actually not illegal to be registered to vote in two states. In fact, it happens all the time when people move or, say, own property in two places. But it is illegal to vote in two states during the same election. That's what Killian did.
I voted in Colorado. I voted in Kansas. I did what I'm accused of doing.
Now, this very rarely happens. Several studies show double voting accounts for less than a tenth of a percent of all votes cast in a typical general election. But that hasn't stopped Kobach from claiming that double voting is widespread. Here's Kobach in a 2015 conversation with KCUR reporter Sam Zeff.
One of the easiest is voting in two different states. It is almost impossible to stop that. 125,000 Kansans are registered in another state, or they were Kansans and are now living in the other state.
How do you know that?
Because we have an interstate cross-check program.
Kobach has refused several interview requests for this story, but we do know that he has compiled a database that holds records on half of all registered voters in the country. Kobach offers cross-check free to states.
It all sounds great. The difficulty is created by how the matches are done.
Mark Johnson is a Kansas City attorney who has battled Kobach in court. Johnson says the cross-check program is too simplistic, checking registrations only by first name, last name, and date of birth. Even Kobach's office admits that the system is rife with, quote, false positives and not double votes. Mark Johnson.
He's grandstanding. He has used this minimal number of prosecutions in a way that I think is inappropriate. He has forced these people to plead guilty to crimes, to pay fines, to hire lawyers.
He's the ACLU's worst nightmare because he knows the Constitution and fights to keep them from making confetti of it. He's Chris Kobach, and this is the Chris Kobach Show.
Kobach has a Sunday night show on a Kansas City AM station, and he's received a lot of attention since Donald Trump tapped him as an advisor on voter fraud and immigration. Kobach also continues to tout the six convictions he's won so far on double voting, all found in CrossCheck. And he maintains that undocumented immigrants are behind the massive voter fraud, but he's offered no proof. So far, Kobach has convicted one male Democrat, one Republican woman, and four older Republican men like Randall Killian.
I just want to say that I have nothing against Chris Kobach. You know, I think he made a promise to the Kansas people that that's what he was going to do.
Killian gets upset talking about the charges, especially since he had a spotless record, not even a parking ticket. He talked to KCUR because he says he wants people to know his side of the story, something Kobach never sought.
He was able to see what he wanted to see and felt like he could make a case which would enhance his opportunity for political advancement.
Out thousands of dollars to pay an attorney, Killian says he pleaded no contest because he couldn't afford to spend more to fight the charges. He doesn't want to say how he voted on Colorado's marijuana law. In fact, he will only say that he doesn't vote at all anymore. And he's not registered to vote. Anywhere. For Here and Now, I'm Peggy Lowe.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.